song. So you have this to refer to if you don't have very good notes on the film. There are quotations from some of the people you saw in the film, including Dr. Thomas Oss and others, that you will find in here. And it kind of summarizes what that film was about, The Art of Freudian Slippage. Strongly recommend that to you. Second handout I gave you. This is the outline I will be following. I gave you an introductory preliminary outline last time. This one contains material that was not covered in the other. So each of them has something that you need to be, make sure that you're responsible for. This is the sequence, the order that we will be following. If there are any changes, I will point those out to you as we go through. If you look at the back of that handout, that's what you need to know up at the top. Important terms and concepts. There may just be a connection between the use of that word, concepts, and the conceptual questions on your next test. How about that? Underneath that, if there are terms that are used in a particular way in terms of my lecture, or what I talk about in here that may be somewhat different than the terminology used by the authors of your book or in the films, I took the liberty of defining some of those terms for you in terms of how they will be used in my class. The rest of the ones in that list are your responsibility. These are the ones that I defined for you. Last handout that I gave you. You lose this thing or don't read it, may God have mercy on your soul. And when you're reading it, I strongly recommend that you don't sneeze or blink. You'll miss something important. Overview of psychoanalytic theory is a detailed presentation of the material that is often considered to be the most important stuff in Freud's psychoanalytic theory. When you get to page 6, it talks about the psychology of adjustment and the ego defense mechanisms. And when you get to page 7, it talks about the concept of libido, which I will also be talking about in here. But the initial part of that, yes, sir?
May I cover sequence that don't die?
Yeah, why don't you come down and get them? I already passed them out. Yeah. Who else had a question? Since we've already derailed the train of thought. Okay, those are materials, and I said to you once upon a time, in the beginning of the semester, if I give you something in writing, technically I shouldn't have to teach about it. You're responsible for its content. I will be teaching about that material, but you better make sure that you address that material with great thoroughness in your preparation for the second test that we have. And of the three things that I just gave you, I would suggest that that outline, it gives you all the material you're responsible for, and the one called Overview of Psychoanalytic Theory are of critical importance, at least not presented in the manner in which it's going to be presented here. If you look at the outline that I gave you, the second handout that was distributed, you will see right at the very top of that outline, Roman numerals 1, 2, and 3. Roman numerals 1 and 2 represent, permission to take, by the way, represent the first way in which Sigmund Freud attempted to understand the structure and function of the human psychological makeup. They're called the structural elements in Freud's psychoanalytic theory. First, what you see on the left board here, the structure of the mind. The mental or, quote, psychic apparatus, unquote, as Freud referred to it initially. He later changed the name of it because people kept getting it confused with the other. The mistake was made in the film that you saw. Sam Waterston, in talking about what is on the board, said another model of the mind. No, he's wrong. That is Freud's view of the personality, not the mind. So we have the structure of the mind on the left. We have the structure of the personality. Let me put this up here on this side. Freud could have called it the personality, but he chose not to do that. And he chose instead to use the phrase intrapsychic system in order to emphasize his point of view that everybody's personality is not a thing. It is not a single entity that exists within the person, but it is a personality system that is made up of three separate but interacting subparts. And once those three parts are fully formed, everything that a person does in terms of their activity, their behavior, their character, is a direct byproduct of the continuous interaction of the three parts. Never does anything happen in one to the exclusion of the other two, but whatever goes on in one of those affects the other two. Everything we do is a result of the continuous interaction of the three. Now, all three aren't present when we're born. But once the system is up and running and all parts are formed, then everything we do is an outgrowth of the interaction of the three. We have talked about the levels of the mind, and we talked about that previously when we talked about the psychoanalytic school. Today we're going to talk about what's on the right board, and in between, what do you see? Well, that is, in fact, a diagram, a schematic illustration of how these two structural concepts overlap, how they interface with one another, I think is the terminology they like to use. Which parts of the personality, for example, are at which level of mental function? Now, Freud, when he first started, he began studying the mind and how it worked in 1885. He felt that he and his colleagues had come up with a satisfactory explanation of the mind and how the mind functions by 1925. For the non-math majors in the group, that's 40 years. That's not 2 weeks. That's not 6 months. That's not a quick fix. That is a slow, meticulous, careful work by Freud and his colleagues trying to come up with a comprehensive picture of how the mind works. Anything that takes that long, you're bound to begin to venture into other areas. The second thing that Freud got involved with while still working on trying to come up with an effective picture of the mind and mental functioning and how it works was the structure of personality. And I said to you once upon a time, Freud was the first person historically who said, we're not born with our personalities intact. It is not a byproduct of heredity and genetics. Our personality, said Freud, undergoes its own slow, gradual, evolutionary process of development over the course of our lifetime, particularly our early lifetime. And as our personality evolves, it is those experiences that occur earliest on in life that play the most decisive role, have the greatest impact. Freud, now take a look at the center. As you'll see, some people in reading Freud assume that this structure of the personality is at this level. The next structure is at the next level. The next structure is at... No, they overlap. Look at the diagram. There is only... Freud got interested in this because originally he thought that maybe there was a part of our personality that corresponded to each of the different levels of mental activity. He later abandoned that notion because he only found one-to-one correspondence in one area. The part that we're born with, the id, is completely unconscious. The other two overlap, preconscious and conscious. So that's what the diagram in the middle is about, and there's a couple of other things about that diagram that need to be made mention of. Look at the top structure. That's the last one that develops. Überreich, as Freud called it, or the superego, the overseer. That's the only part of the personality, says Freud, that is entirely and completely learned. It's acquired as a result of our relationships with the important people in our life when we're young who provide for us and take care of us, who nurture us and love us and protect us. It's largely an outgrowth of parent-child interaction, and that superego, says Freud, really has two parts. Look at them in the diagram. On the right side, you see something called the ego ideal. That consists of everything that we are taught is correct, is proper, is nice, is kind, is thoughtful. Anything for which we ever received praise or approval or affection or attention or recognition, that's learned as the things that we should do, the things that we should be. On the other side of that top structure, the superego, you see something called the conscience. And that consists of everything we were ever taught, anything we ever learned was wrong or bad or sinful or naughty or unkind or rude or inconsiderate, anything for which we were ever punished, disciplined, ridiculed, humiliated, embarrassed, smacked, spanked, whatever. That's all of the should not. That's all of the don'ts. Those things are also learned. And they are stored in that other part of the superego. So there's two halves of that. The do's and the don'ts, the shoulds and the shouldn'ts. We'll get back to that. Now let's go over to the list of things on the board on the right side. We're going to pick up today with a discussion of the personality, according to Freud, the personality structure. There are some people who take exception to the terminology that Freud used and their belief that he made up terms to describe parts of the personality, etc. Shame on the people who think that. It's what I call the arrogance of ignorance. It's not true. Sigmund Freud was a physician, and all physicians at the time had to learn Latin. They wrote all their prescriptions in Latin. The terms that he used for the different parts of the personality are Latin terms. The one near the bottom, we're going to start with that one. That's the part that we're born with. He called the id, translated from Latin into English, means it. It is the biological component of the personality. It is made up of all of our unlearned, physically and physiologically based needs. Everything that is essential to our survival as a person, everything that is essential to our survival as mankind is pre-programmed and present at birth in the biological component of the personality, Freud called the id. Everything that's essential to self-preservation, to our survival, and to be able to thrive as an individual is in that part of the, in a biological sense, is in that part of the personality. Before we get too far down the road, let's make clear that Freud believes that each of these parts of the personality, number one, operates on the basis of its own principle. There is a principle that guides each part of the personality. These three parts of the personality do their own job. They don't take over for one another. They don't switch into somebody else's job. Each of them takes care of their own functions. So we have the principle by which it operates, and then we have the main functions of each. This id operates on the basis of what Freud called the pleasure principle. The pleasure principle. We are by nature pleasure-seeking, pain-avoiding organisms. In our day-to-day activities, we strive to secure immediate pleasurable satisfaction of our needs, and we strive to avoid pain and discomfort, those things that might be harmful or injurious to us. That's the pleasure principle. The functions of that part of the personality? Very simple. First way in which it functions, says Freud, reflex action. He said, we all come into this world with an inborn set of automatic behaviors. Behaviors that we exhibit in response to stimulation. They're called reflexes. Something gets in the breathing passages and we sneeze in order to get rid of it. Something gets in the trachea, we cough in order to expel it. Something gets in the eye and the eye starts to blink in water until the irritant is expelled. You gently touch an infant's cheek on the right-hand side, they turn their head to the right. You touch their lips and they begin to suck. You put your finger in the palm of a newborn's hand, they grab and hold on. It's called the grasping reflex. Sudden loud noises, bright flashing lights, the sensation of loss of support causes an infant to curl up in a self-protective posture called the startle reflex. Pulls its knees up to its abdomen, pulls its head down, puts its arms up in a protective posture, slackens the jaw in an effort to protect itself. There's a whole set of automatic inborn behaviors that we exhibit that we don't have to think about. Automatic functions. That's one of the things, says Freud, the id does. It is in control of all of our involuntary automatic reflex behavior. Yes. Automatic functions, automatic behaviors. You put food in the infant's mouth, and as they swallow it, there's automatic peristaltic movement of the intestinal tract to digest the food. When the bladder fills, it automatically drains when it's full. When the bowel fills, it automatically evacuates. All reflex action. The id is in charge of that, says Freud. Those are all biologically based functions. Second way in which this id functions, says Freud, is by means of something he called primary process. Primary process is not a physical activity, it's a mental activity. Primary process is your ability to create a vivid mental picture, a mental image. Think of it as imagery. A vivid mental picture of something that would satisfy some strong need that's going on inside you. That's primary process. If I ask people in here to think of their favorite food and they close their eyes and think of it, they can actually picture their favorite food. If they concentrate really hard, they can almost see it, almost taste it, and almost smell it. That is primary process. Freud often called it wishing. Today we call it imagining or fantasizing. The ability to create a vivid mental picture of something that we would find pleasurable, satisfying, or enjoyable that would meet some need that we have. Now please note in your notes, it doesn't actually satisfy any need. It provides momentary states of satisfaction, pleasure. What it is a stalling tactic. It happens in order to enable us to postpone or delay engaging in behavior to actually satisfy that need that's going on inside us until the correct time and place are at hand for us to do it in reality rather than in fantasy. Imagining, fantasizing, imagery, pictures. Obviously, if the infant is going to survive, it's got to be able to do more than fantasize about something that would satisfy its needs. A hungry infant can fantasize about the bottle all it wants to and die of malnutrition. Freud says, in order to survive, we have to carry out real transactions with the real external environment. Now, here's the important point. The id can't do that because Freud said the id is only aware of what's going on inside you. Are you hungry? Are you tired? Are you sleeping? Are you sick? Are you in pain? Are you frustrated? So the id is only aware of the internal environment. It has no contact with the outside world. So here's where the plot thickens, don't get lost. Sigmund Freud was a very astute observer. He observed that human infants have a longer period of complete and total helplessness and dependency on another for survival than any other form of life on the planet. Most other species, when they're a few hours old or maybe a day or two old, they can struggle to stand up on their own 2 feet, 4 feet. They can actively participate in obtaining their own nourishment. Human infants come into this world with certain limitations because of the immaturity of their nervous system, their skeletal system, their muscular system, There is nothing that human infants can do about meeting their own needs. When they are in a state of need, the only thing they can do to express that need is to cry. And they must have entered into a relationship with an adult caregiver that is such that that person is familiar enough with that infant, or through process of elimination, they can figure out what's wrong. Does it need to be fed? Does it need to be changed? Does it need to be rocked? Does it need to go to sleep? Does it need to be held and comforted? Does it need medication? Is it ill? So it's the adult caregiver who has to decipher and figure out what the infant needs, because the human infant can't even verbally express what its needs are. All it can do when it's in a state of need is cry. And the adult caregiver is the one that has to figure out what that cry means. Why is it crying? What kind of a cry? And anybody who's a parent will tell you that very early on, after your child is born, you figure out the difference between an angry cry and a painful cry and a sick cry and a tired cry and a hungry cry. Same damn cry. No one else knows. But because of the close connection and the bonding between you and the infant, you're able to figure it out. So Freud said, for infants to survive, they've got to have this special relationship with an adult caregiver. And in caring for the infant and meeting its needs, listen carefully, that adult caregiver doesn't have to be the mother. More often than not, it's the mother. It can be the grandmother. It can be an aunt. It can be a surrogate parent. It can be the father. Doesn't have to be female. That person has to care for the infant's needs, and in the process of doing so, they bombard that infant with an incredible amount of external stimulation. And so through the special senses of the body, especially the sense of touch, which is our largest sense organ, that person, in caring for the infant through such activities as feeding and rocking and bathing and diapering and holding and caressing and talking to and singing to and walking with, that person provides a tremendous amount of external stimulation. And that, says Freud, is what redirects the interest and attention of the infant away from what's going on inside its body to what's happening outside. When that happens, and listen carefully, the time frame for this is from between birth and 2 weeks of age. Through all of that external stimulation, it redirects the interest and attention of the infant away from what's going on inside to what's going on outside, and that represents the beginning of the formation of the ego, second structure of personality. A word which translated from Latin into English means I. Awareness of oneself. Before we're born, we are part of another organism for 9 months. Job one, says Freudian theory, first developmental task for any human being is to determine that we're no longer a part of that person and they're not an extension of us and that we're separate and distinct. You cannot begin to understand your relationship to the environment around you until you know where you leave off and the environment begins. And it's through the interaction with that person that we discover that and develop that sense of self. That's what his use of the term ego means. It's the original for the phrase self-concept. It's the original awareness of self. I, me. That other person who cares for the infant, says Freud, becomes associated with the following: warmth and comfort and the alleviation of pain and discomfort, satisfaction, stimulation, excitement. That person comes to be associated with the satisfaction of all of that infant's needs. They are the gravy train. Therefore, whenever that person is present and in the room and that baby is awake, that person is the focus of the infant's attention. So a special connection or relationship called bonding occurs between caregiver and infant. Once that person becomes the central focus of the infant's attention when it's awake, then what happens is this, says Freud. That person then begins to slowly and systematically redirect the interest and attention of the infant away from herself or himself to the rest of the environment, pointing out things, describing things, explaining things, This is your bottle, and this is a rattle, and that's your father, and this is your sister, this is your brother, and this is a toy. That person, says Freud, becomes, and I'm using his terminology here, the interpreter of reality to the child, describing and explaining everything and redirecting the focus of the child's attention and awareness to all things that are external to it. So in a sense, what we're saying is that this person shapes the basic outlook and awareness of the child. They become the bridge between the child and external reality. That is, please listen, the first social relationship we ever enter into with another human being. That is the first interpersonal relationship we ever have. And Freud tells us that it establishes the basic tone and quality of all future relationships with other people that we're going to have, the nature and quality of that very first relationship. It's the original learning experience in terms of relating to others. What's the principle by which the ego operates? Freud calls it the reality principle. It comes into this world to perceive reality. After it perceives reality, the second thing it does is to test reality to make sure that what it's perceiving is real rather than imagined. So the ego is the part of the personality that can tell the difference between what's fantasized or imagined and what's real. Then after it tests reality and makes sure that it's real rather than imagined or hallucinated, then what it does is figure out a way of interacting with reality in order to satisfy our needs. The reality principle. What are the functions of the ego? I hope you've left some room on the page. There's a whole profusion of them. There are so many responsibilities and jobs that the ego have that that's why Freud calls the ego, and I quote, the executive of the personality. He refers to it as the executive function of the ego. That ego is the planner, the chooser, the decision maker. It operates by means of what Freud called secondary process. Not primary, secondary. What is secondary process? If we use a generic term, it's Freud's term for thinking. That ego, says Freud, has at its disposal the use of all of our higher mental abilities. So it's the intellectual component of our personality. It has at its disposal such things as perception and thinking and learning and memory and judgment and reasoning and problem solving, decision making. So it carries out all of those functions. In addition to that, says Freudian theory, the ego is in charge of all of our voluntary behaviors, not the reflexes, everything we choose to do, everything we decide to do. Gee, I think I'll do so-and-so. That's an ego function. It's in charge of all of our voluntary movement, coordination, behavior. Voluntary activity. Everything you decide to do. Next, and we mentioned this before, but I'm just going to describe it differently, that ego is responsible for your self-concept. Being aware of who you are. Who you are, what you're about, and what you're like. It is also, said Freud, responsible for your feelings of self-worth, your feelings of self-esteem, value as a person. And it's also in charge of protecting you from those things that would destabilize your personality. Those things that you might perceive as threatening or dangerous, whether real or imagined, and defending and protecting you from those things, either internal or external, that might adversely impact your personality by means of using what's called the ego defense mechanisms. Look at the bottom of the first page of the outline. That's another one of the ego functions, protecting us. Our feelings of dignity, our feelings of self-worth, our feelings of wholeness and integrity. So if you look at the bottom of page one of that outline, you'll see. Now before your eyes glaze over and roll back in your head after seeing that list down there, let me tell you in all fairness, I've listed 12 of those ego defense mechanisms that we're going to talk about. That's a partial list. Freud suggests that there are about 25 of them. Those are the one dozen, the 12, that are the most commonly used by everybody. And therefore, they're the ones you're going to be held responsible for that we're going to go over in class. Not the ones that are perhaps somewhat extreme or esoteric that are used by people with varying degrees of maladjustment. These are the ones that normal, healthy people use. And we're all normal and healthy, and we all use all of those as long as we use them within appropriate limits. If we start to use some of them too much, we can run into problems, and we'll talk about that later. But that's the one dozen defense mechanisms, including the two doubles that are on that list, that you will be held responsible for. And they are ego functions. Those are things that the ego uses to take care of us. Now let's take a look at the superego. The principle by which it operates, Freud uses two terms interchangeably here. One he uses early on in his writings, and then as his theory matures, he uses another term. It operates on the basis of what he called originally the morality principle. He also uses the phrase the perfection principle. The superego is the social and moral component of the personality. As we said earlier when we were talking about the diagram, let me give you Freud's take on this. He said, the family is the aggregate of every society that's charged with the responsibility of developing in each new offspring an awareness of society's values, standards, expectations, and demands. And I would add to that, as they are interpreted to you by your parents and other important people in your life. The superego, then, is the internal representation of the values of your culture and your subculture and your society as they are explained to you by your parents and other socializing adults. I'm sorry. Where are you? The internal representation. You want the chapter and verse on this? According to psychoanalytic theory, that superego is an internal self-regulatory control mechanism that we learn through interacting with our parents. It's the mechanism that enables us to guide and direct our own behavior in a way that's consistent with the way we're raised and what we're taught is right versus wrong, good versus bad, moral versus immoral, acceptable, unacceptable, legal, illegal, ethical, unethical, etc. On and on and on. Now what you need to know about this superego is that there's no compromise, folks. As far as the superego is concerned, it's either right or wrong, good or bad, moral or immoral. Everything is either black or white. There is no gray. Those of us who are involved as amateur artists know that the human eye is capable of perceiving 176 shades of gray. Not for Freud. It's either black or white. There is no gray. Yes or no, right or wrong, good or bad. It deals only with things in extremes. Absolutes. What are the functions of the superego? Hell, we went over everybody else's job. Let's deal with this. Number one. It is the superego's job to get you to substitute idealistic goals for realistic ones. To always do what's right, to always do what's correct, to always do what's proper, to always be nice, to always be kind, considerate, thoughtful. Do the right thing. Number two, superego's job is to influence the ego to inhibit the impulsive behavior that originates in your id. Inhibit your impulsivity, to not act on impulse, to think before you act, to think before you speak, to think it over, to inhibit your impulses. In little kids, it isn't working, so the kid's sitting there eating a bowl of chocolate pudding, and a bug lands on his chocolate pudding. If he gets the urge to squish the bug, he does. Chocolate pudding everywhere. No impulse control. He's not able to inhibit his impulsivity. Last is the first thing that I gave you when I was talking about it. Last function of the superego, to get you to strive for perfection. To always be correct. To always do the proper thing. To always do the correct thing. Okay, don't get lost. Freud's theory is often referred to as a conflict model of personality. It is entirely possible, and it is often the case, that each of us may experience multiple but incompatible needs in the id. That's called id conflict. You're tired and horny at the same time. What do you do? Look around the room and see who's with you. There's nobody there. Maybe you go to sleep. But then again, maybe you don't. Ego conflict. Every time you have to make a choice or a decision, every time you have to pick this or that, and this process begins the first time somebody says to you, no, I said you could either have chocolate pudding with whipped cream or vanilla fudge ice cream. Now, which one do you want? But no, you can't have both. Every time you have to make a choice and a decision, that's ego conflict. This or that. What do? How do I solve this problem? Which do I want? If I have this, I know I can't have that, and I don't want to give that up, so what do? That's ego conflict. Superego conflict. Every single time you have to choose between two rights or two wrongs, or a right and a wrong that are of equal strength, that is superego conflict. So there is potential for an incredible amount of conflict between and among within each of the parts. That's a drop in the bucket. Id, superego. Seesaw, fulcrum. In the middle, the ego. Please note in your notes, the id and the superego are diametrically in opposition to one another. They are 180 degrees apart. They are the exact opposite. The id says, if it feels good, do it. Superego replies, yes, and what would your mother think if she were watching you right now? Perfection versus pleasure. In the middle is the ego. Now, this is why Freud said, and I'm only going to say this once, that ego for Freud has to be the largest, the strongest, and the healthiest part of your personality, the most fully developed. Why? Because it is the only rational, reasonable, logical, common sense part of your personality. Its job is to withstand the relentless demands of the two irrational parts, the id and the superego, both of which in their own way are irrational components of the personality. Relentless, demanding, pushy. And the opposite of each other. So the ego's job then is to be the mediator. Its job is to find the compromise, to settle the dispute, to find ways of satisfying your needs, either fully or in part, that are acceptable to your conscience and to your society and your values and your standards, to find a way of satisfying your needs in socially acceptable ways that are acceptable to you. Often it's able to do that. That's its job, depending on the size and strength of the ego and how well developed it is. Often it isn't able to do that. So what it does is to give in to the superego, perhaps, and you feel righteous and deprived. You get a bad case of the poor me blues. What the hell, everybody else is going. Why should I have to stay home and study for a Western Civ exam? Damn it. Sometimes it gives in to the id, and you feel satisfied and guilty as hell. Catch 22. Either way, you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. It's a two-edged sword. Satisfied but guilty, maybe ashamed, a little embarrassed, a little sheepish. There are those who like to play head games with themselves. Well, I'm really going to study for that Western Civ exam. I'll just go to the party for a little while. Or the one I love. I'll go to the party, but I'll make sure I get up really early in the morning, take a shower, and then study right before the... Yeah, sure. Okay. This is the internal struggle that we deal with all the time. And listen to this, Freud says, life is a never-ending process by which we endeavor to resolve our inner conflicts. That's why it's called a conflict model. We are constantly in conflict with ourselves, and what we attempt to do is to resolve those conflicts the best way we can. And that's the ego's job, and it's the toughest job. And it can't always find an appropriate compromise. And I want you to know that that superego, even though it's concerned with right or wrong, is just as crazy, just as irrational, and just as relentlessly demanding as the id. And if you're one of those people who sometimes suffers from a guilty conscience, you know how well you can beat yourself up at times. And that's what that superego is there for. To get you to guide your own behavior, to walk the straight and narrow in a way that's consistent with reality as it has been interpreted to you by your parents and other socializing adults. Maybe a grandparent. What? Don't close your notebooks. Don't leave here lost.
Okay. You know how you said life is a never-ending process?
Yes.
What part is that again?
That is the intrapsychic system. We're in conflict with ourselves either within the subparts of the intrapsychic system or between and among the two that are opposing each other.
Okay.
Next. I won't be sitting next to you during our next test, so if you have any questions about this, ask them now. And what we've just gone over, you're not going to find it addressed in your textbook. I have absolute respect for Dr. Jerome Kagan, but he didn't have the kind of training in psychoanalytic work that I did. So if you've got any questions, now's the time to talk.